Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
To the states, or any one of them, or any city of the states, resist much, obey little. Once unquestioning obedience, once fully enslaved, no nation, state, city of this earth ever afterward resumes its liberty. Let me read that again. The orthography is a little bit strange. This is Walt Whitman, who's not one of my favorite poets by any means, not one of my favorite poets or one of my favorite personalities, but I find a lot of wisdom in this brief little excursion into the poetical art on the part of weirdo Walt Whitman. To the states, or any one of them, or any city of the states, resist much, obey little. Once unquestioning obedience, once fully enslaved. Once fully enslaved, no nation, state, city of this earth ever afterward resumes its liberty. I'm struck by this as a summation of the attitude we have to have right now with respect to anything that is done by the distant and imponderably evil Leviathan in Washington. What we need right now is centrifugal activism, not centripetal activism. We need to be doing everything we can to break up the mass of this emerging singularity, if you will, this economic and political monstrosity. We have to break up the mass before it becomes a fully functioning singularity that tears a hole in the space-time continuum and devours everything in its path, becoming so unfathomably dense and powerful that not even light can escape. And so I, of necessity and by disposition, am suspicious of any campaign or event that beckons people toward the imperial capital on the assumption that gathering in their masses the helots from across the fruited plain can somehow purge and sanctify the evil of that government and turn it into a mechanism to accomplish good in the world. We don't need people gathering at the feet of that monstrous pagan shrine, sitting in prostrate abject wonder at the deified Lincoln, who sits there placidly on a throne decorated with fascists. The fascists, of course, are the symbol appropriated by Benito Mussolini, who was one of Lincoln's many imitators in the 20th century. We don't need that type of attitude and that type of activism in order to reclaim our freedom. What we need instead would be what the Tea Party movement originally betokened, which is an effort to reclaim for the states, for the cities of the states, for the localities, the reserved powers the Constitution supposedly was designed to protect, in order to provide buffers against the ambitions of distant rulers. I have to insert a very important qualification here when I'm talking about what is commonly referred to as states' rights. First of all, I don't like the expression, states don't have rights. People as individuals have rights. That's the only way that the concept of rights makes any sense. For the purpose of convenience, I'll refer to this concept as states' rights. I prefer to refer to this as reserved powers or the principle of subsidiarity, but these are rather unfamiliar locutions, so I'll say states' rights, just once again in the interest of conversational ease. States' rights is useful in terms of preventing, or at least now battling, the depredations of a centralized, what in the founding documents we see referred to as a unitary state. You don't want to have something that is monolithic. That's what we read time and time again in the Federalist Papers. Even in the works of people who are centralizers, like Madison and like Hamilton, there are these warnings against the idea of consolidation of power and a unitary authority. So it's useful, that concept, to that extent. But some people who fetishize states' rights seem to believe that because there are reserve powers of the states under the 10th Amendment, and as Madison pointed out in Federalist Paper Number 10, there are all kinds of silly things that state governments can do that the federal government is forbidden to do, that the states should be doing these things, or at least it's defensible for the states to do these things. And among the things that Madison mentioned were the establishment of a state religion or religious denomination, the emission of paper currency, the redistribution of wealth. There are all kinds of things that a state can do while remaining technically a republic for the purpose of membership in the union. Or, for that matter, a state can withdraw from the union and decide to be a monarchy or to be a mass democracy or to be some form of totalitarian socialist body. My view is that states' rights are useful and beneficial and justifiable only in as much as they enhance protections for life, liberty, and property, rather than detracting from them. So while it's true, for instance, that the state of New York could repeal the provision in its state constitution, I believe it's Article 14, I'll have to go back and check, don't hold me to that, dealing with religious liberty, and establish a denomination or a faith tradition as the official religion, I would prefer that they not do this. I don't think that that is a just and defensible exercise of the reserved powers that states enjoy under our constitutional scheme. And that, of course, is a subject which has come up in light of this completely manufactured and phony controversy over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. Time after time, I have received emails or communications from people rebuking me for defending the property rights of this group to buy and develop this piece of commercial real estate as a Muslim center. And I'm told this is not a constitutional issue, this is an issue of states' rights. Well, under the existing Constitution of New York, it is a matter of religious liberty. And unfortunately, under a measure that was passed in 2000, in terms of the zoning and planning aspects of this controversy, there is a federal law that I think is facially unconstitutional that would forbid the state government of New York from rezoning that property in such a way that a mosque could not be built there, if you want to refer to this edifice as a mosque, which I think is a somewhat unreliable way of describing it. There was a measure passed in 2000 with bipartisan support and with very conspicuous support from many of the people now criticizing the Cordoba Initiative and the people who want to buy and develop this Muslim community center. Many of those people back in 2000 said this is a wonderful thing because now the federal government's intervening to prevent land use, zoning, and planning decisions that would infringe on religious liberty. Well, there's the petard on which they have now been hoisted. Because that is the type of federal intervention that the 10th Amendment, the 9th Amendment, supposedly would prevent. And in this case, the law is not on the side of those who want to constrict the religious and, more importantly, of course, in terms of the constitutional question, the property rights of the people who have negotiated in good faith and secured a lease on that building and are exercising their property rights to build a community center. Many people have said that under the reserve powers of the state of New York, we don't have a First Amendment issue, we don't have anything more complicated than a zoning issue. Even if you take out of the equation that law passed 10 years ago, my point is that states' rights can be just as insidious in terms of undermining property rights and personal rights as a distant unitary state could be. Rather than having one despot 3,000 miles away, we're dealing with 3,000 despots 1 mile away, and that's not a net improvement for individual liberty. But back to the question of what was going on today at the so-called Faith, Hope, and Charity Rally in New York City, or New York City, forgive me, the other of the twin capitals of our metastasizing empire, Washington, D.C., also known as Trantor, also known as Mordor. Why on earth would people believe that the healthy and appropriate course of action would be to gather at the feet of the individual who, more than any other figure in American history, was the maker of the monstrosity under which we now suffer, and then petition that monstrosity, that it would exert the powers that it has usurped from us in ways that we would consider more appropriate? And I guess more to the point, why, in a putative celebration of faith, hope, and charity, and in an act of reaching beyond the political into the realm of God and His grace, would we see these ritualistic, liturgical invocations of the sacred and ennobling mission of the military arm of that same government. According to the Los Angeles Times account, we read the following. Set at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial on a sun-drenched afternoon, Beck's Restoring Honor rally was heavily religious and not overtly political. Speaker after speaker praised the nation's military, its founding fathers, and Lincoln. Faith, hope, and charity? I don't think so. I'll elaborate on that thought in just a minute. This is Will Grigg with Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a minute.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
I should be glad to meet with someone who could tell me what has become of the Union, in what it consists, and to what useful purpose it endures. Oh, boy. That was from a letter written by Gouverneur Morris. He's the guy who actually wrote the text of the Constitution. So obviously in 1787, he was an ardent Unionist. This letter was written on October 17, 1814, to Timothy Pickering, who was a rather sour and dyspeptic proponent of secession. He was a Federalist who didn't want to be governed by Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans. And so in 1814, after enduring a couple of terms under Jefferson, and now they were into the reign of James Madison, and at this point people were wondering if Virginia was actually going to be creating some kind of a dynasty in terms of the presidency, Mr. Morris wrote this letter expressing his chagrin over the existence of a union he had helped to assemble. And this, of course, was in the context of an emerging catastrophic war with Great Britain that is sort of gestated in the later years of Thomas Jefferson's second term, and that's one of the blots on his record, quite frankly, was the way that he mismanaged the diplomacy with Great Britain that created problems that coalesced into the War of 1812. By 1814, it was a full-blown disaster, and it looked as if there was going to be a fissure, that the New England states, who were sick of the embargoes and other measures that had interdicted their trade with Great Britain, and of course weary of the war and the ambitions of the war hawks seeking to grab part of Canada, they actually met at Hartford, Connecticut, in a period that sort of straddled 1814 and 1815, and in the Hartford Convention they actually considered the possibility of secession from the United States, at a time when the United States looked like it might be falling apart under the fusillade of British aggression. And if it hadn't been for that squalid little Corsican Napoleon who was cutting up trouble once again in Europe and thereby distracting Great Britain, it's entirely possible that the Union would have fallen apart. Well, Gouverneur Morris, the guy who was the penman of the Constitution, was saying he could live with that. He could live with the idea of the Union falling apart because, to his perception at the time, it really wasn't serving the purposes it was advertised to serve. In another letter he wrote a little bit later, he made an observation that I think is appropriate for what happened today at the so-called Restoring Honor rally, which, according to one account I'm reading here, was a bit of a bust. This is what Morris wrote to Benjamin Walker, quote, "The people must feel before they can think. Expect heroism from a sheep, charity from a wolf, and music from a crow, and perhaps you may not be disappointed. But do not expect or even hope for reason from the populace." He's talking about people in the mass. By the way, these quotes are from a wonderful new book by Bill Kaufman entitled Bye Bye, Miss American Empire, Neighborhood Patriots, Backcountry Rebels, and Their Underdog Crusades to Redraw America's Political Map. And it's a wonderful read. I'm about halfway through it. Got it a couple of days ago. Bill Kaufman is somebody I greatly enjoy. He's a self-described New York rural secessionist. He is a wonderful stylist, wonderful prose stylist, a tremendous historian, and one of the finest wordsmiths of our generation. And I'm also equally enchanted with most of his political principles, although we disagree about some things. But the point he makes is that we can disagree agreeably as long as neither one of us is trying to use the power of the state to compel the other one to profess an agreement with the principle that he doesn't agree with, if you'll forgive me for the rather inelegant way I phrase that observation. He's one of these people who believes that if we allow the vociferous tendencies in our vast and continent-spanning empire to play out, we'll have a number of Americas that will be occupying the same land mass, and they could be trading partners, commercial partners. You could have cultural exchanges. We would probably have some kind of an international consortium with respect to professional sports, rather than having Major League Baseball being binational in the sense of having Canadian franchises in Toronto and Montreal. I don't know if Montreal still got a franchise. No, they no longer do. Anyhow, rather than having binational franchises in that sense, we could have multinational competition the way that they have in Europe with the soccer leagues, for instance. But, of course, be playing baseball, which is a far worthier and far nobler undertaking. But I'd hardly recommend this book to you. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, White River Junction, Vermont. And he is quite enchanted with Vermont because in Vermont you have a large and politically eclectic secessionist movement that has sprung up. In any case, this idea about not expecting reason from the populace that was expressed by Gouverneur Morris has to do with the fact that people in the mass, for whatever reason, when they submerge their individuality, they surrender their capacity for discernment, and altogether too frequently, for moral restraint. I think it was P.J. O'Rourke who once said that there is this vague odor of incipient thuggishness that hovers over any political gathering, no matter how charitable or how faithful, how pious the gathering's advertised purposes might be. When you get people in the mass acting in unison, there is something scary about it. And that has to do, once again, I think, with the kernel of wisdom we find in that somewhat hackneyed cliche about people losing their minds in masses and regaining their senses one at a time. And there, of course, is that observation in the cinematic classic Men in Black about how man, the individual, the human being, that particular specific individual human being can be intelligent and judicious and restrained, but people in a bunch tend to be manipulable. And that, once again, underscores my biggest problem with any kind of a mass function of this sort. Where do they gather? They gather in Washington, D.C. Why do they gather in Washington, D.C.? Because Washington, D.C. is the fulcrum point of the known universe in terms of politics and economics, and altogether too often in terms of culture. Should it be that way? No, it shouldn't. So why do you gather there? The assumption is that by combining our resources and pooling our influence, we can take this huge instrument of evil and somehow redirect it in ways that are good and worthwhile and useful, commendable, noble, and sacred. You know what that is? And Glenn Beck, of all people, would likely take issue with what I'm about to say, but he couldn't refute it. That's liberation theology. Now, a couple of days ago, I think it was this past Tuesday, I happened to catch a segment of Mr. Beck's radio program in which he was talking about liberation theology of the conventional left-wing variety. One of the things he said is that the critique offered by the left, and this, of course, is a true and reliable observation on Mr. Beck's part to this extent, the critique offered by the radical left is that government in the hands of those not similarly enlightened as the leftists becomes an engine of oppression and exploitation. What has to happen is that they have to take control of that government and turn it into something that is an instrument of progress and equality. And in order to promote this, what the left does is it redefines the terms of its political agenda by transposing them into the key of an adulterated Christianity, and they call this liberation theology. That is exactly what liberation theology is, and that is a pretty good praises of the left-wing approach. The problem is that Mr. Beck is doing exactly the same thing. And it's not even conservative liberation theology that he's promoting. He's promoting exactly the same kind of degenerate, statist, collectivist progressivism that was promoted in the decades before World War I, and he's using exactly the same terms to do it. I'll talk about that in more detail on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Stand by for more Sedition after this. The great national mystery over President Obama's religion, Islamic, follower of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, adherent of the Sunday Morning Church of Golf, has a new twist. How about Latin American liberation theology? Let's roll the tape. Tuesday night, Fox's Glenn Beck was riffing about how recent polls on Mr. Obama show that many Americans, quote, don't recognize him as a Christian. The problem, Mr. Beck said, is that the president does not conform to true Christian values. Let me interject something here. I'm not persuaded that Mr. Obama is a covert Muslim. I'm not persuaded entirely that he was born in Kenya, that he is a Kenyan usurper, that he's a crypto-Islamic Kenyan usurper. Here's my problem with Mr. Obama. It's not that he may be a covert Muslim, it's that he's an overt Marxist. That's the part that I find scandalous. My problem with him is not that he very well may be a Kenyan usurper, but rather he is an unabashed Keynesian when it comes to economics, which is to say he's a corporate socialist. He's a socialist of the sort that Lenin would recognize, given that Lenin's new economic policy, which was sort of the first draft of what Mussolini took and ran with, was sort of an apostasy, if you will, from the pure and undiluted Marxism of the late 19th century. But Mr. Lenin had to adapt, and Lenin understood that the first term of his worldview was that the government has to have total power to rule in any way that the ruling elite saw fit. Power without limit, resting directly on force, was his formula. And to that end, he created a corporatist buffer after pretty much ruining the entire agricultural sector and creating a famine and killing several million people, both directly and indirectly through the famine. Mr. Lenin created the so-called new economic policy as a way of attracting investment capital from the West by creating these corporatist buffers that were controlled by the government but didn't have outright ownership on the part of the government. Now, that was pretty much the template used by Mussolini, which, oddly enough, migrated back to the United States when, back in 1933, April or May of that year, during the 100 days of FDR's first New Deal, the works of Giovanni Gentile and some of the other theoreticians of Mussolini's corporate state were passed around at cabinet meetings by way of providing advice as to how to shape the national economy. So my problem with Obama has to do less with speculative questions about his nativity and nationality and his religious profession, and more to do with his actual record. I don't think we have to paint that particular lily, if you will. But here we have Mr. Beck a couple of days ago talking about why it is that so many people suspect that Mr. Obama might be a covert Muslim. Beck played a montage of clips. By the way, I'm reading from the Christian Science Monitor. Beck played a montage of clips from the president stating variations of the theme that individual and collective salvation are intertwined. Quote, "My individual salvation rests on our collective salvation," says Obama in one clip. That, by the way, is indeed a collectivist heresy, as far as I'm concerned. Beck jumped on this equation as his most critical evidence that the president is not really a Christian and, by implication, not a loyal American. Then he unloaded. "It does not. It does not," he asserted. "That is not a Christian belief." By the way, Mr. Beck is a very dubious exponent of theology. I won't elaborate on that particular observation beyond making it. Rather, Mr. Beck said, it is liberation theology, a Catholic movement aligned with Marxism that originated in Latin America, Brazil, to be specific. They don't make mention of that fact here. I'm interpolating it. Beck then went on to play a clip of Pope Benedict strongly condemning liberation theology. This is what Harold Attridge, dean of the Yale Divinity School, calls a classic shell game, allowing Beck to tar the president twice, first as a non-Christian, then as a disloyal American. This is nothing but political rhetoric, he said after reading a transcript of Beck's Tuesday show. At best, he adds, Beck has a very narrow view of what constitutes true Christianity. There are many Americans with many views of Christian faith that align with what the president believes, Dr. Attridge says, noting that the tradition of individual responsibility to the larger community runs deep in Christian teachings. I'm not going to get into a particularly deep critique of that observation, which is wrong in my opinion, but I want to point out something that I touched on briefly at the end of the last segment, namely that Mr. Beck is promoting liberation theology as well. He's promoting the idea that there is a necessity for a fusion of a certain type of, I don't want to call it Christianity, a certain type of religion, certain type of religious ardor, and certain sacralized civic tenets, what we've seen referred to as a civic religion, if you've read Rousseau and his book on the social contract, his tract, it's called, I call it a monograph or a tract, The Social Contract, he talks about the idea of a civil religion being a state-defined set of tenets or a creed that the subjects of this political arrangement have to profess in order to be considered loyal and decent citizens. They can be forced at the point of a sword, according to Rousseau, to profess belief in these tenets, and if they do not behave in ways that are compatible with those tenets, then the state has the authority to kill them, because they've lied before the law. That's how Rousseau defined the civil religion. Mr. Beck is promoting a type of attenuated civil religion. Here's the difference between the version that he's peddling and the version that Obama and his handlers are promoting. The left-wing civil religion could best be understood in this fashion. As Mr. Beck correctly said, they critique the existing government and its institutions of power, its arrangements for regimenting society. They critique it on the basis of what they call social justice and equality. And they say that in order to bring about a just and truly righteous world, it is necessary for the right people to have control of the instruments of government coercion, and they have to redirect them in ways that promote egalitarianism in social affairs, a more equitable distribution of wealth, that promote the downtrodden who previously had been held under the heel of the state. This can only be done if you have the right vanguard elite running the instruments of power. And Beck quite properly says this is Marxism, and he quite properly abominates it. With respect to domestic policy, the radical left's version of liberation theology focuses on what they call economic violence, what they refer to, of course, as the inequities of capitalism that require a more active role on the part of the government in taking control of the means of production, or just simply seizing the products of labor and distributing them according to some abstract formula of social justice. That's what happens domestically in the left-wing version of the liberation theology. Internationally, liberation theology of the left emphasizes solidarity with similarly situated and similarly ambitious movements in other countries, where you have governments that are overtly Marxist or Marxism attenuated with some form of spirituality or religion. Regimes, for instance, like that of Da Silva in Brazil or Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Then the left domestically in this country reaches out in a fraternal embrace for such movements. They went gaga over the Sandinistas in Nicaragua for that precise reason. Miguel Descoto and some of the other people who were members of that squalid little government were people who had clerical training and professed to be, in the case of Miguel Descoto, he was a Jesuit-trained Catholic cleric. albeit an apostate one. He got dressed down on the tarmac of the Managua Airport in 1982 by the late Pope John Paul II, if I remember correctly. And with respect to matters of war, the radical left is not pacifist. Liberation theology does envision an active role for military force exercised by the government in the interests of promoting progressive ideals. Mr. Beck's least favorite figure in American history isn't Barack Obama, it's Woodrow Wilson. That's a good choice, too. Woodrow Wilson, I would contend, was merely the son and heir of the president at whose foot, or at the foot of whose statue, Mr. Beck was waddling around this morning and this afternoon. He doesn't make that connection for some reason. But Wilson's foreign policy, Wilsonianism, is about using the power of the government to promote righteousness as understood in the framework of the late 19th, early 20th century version of what we now call liberation theology. Now, with respect to the right-wing version of liberation theology, the critique is that you have to reclaim these high and exalted positions in government on behalf of true values. And rather than intervening in the economy, you intervene in the culture. You use the power of the government punitively and coercively to promote traditional culture. And with respect to foreign affairs, there's no difference in practical terms between what the left-wing version and the right-wing version of liberation theology preach. And Mr. Beck is 5 by 5 right in line with the radical left liberation theology when it comes to military affairs. And I'll talk about that a little bit more on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 here on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back at you in just a minute. So liberation theology on the left emphasizes the idea of intervening in the economy in the interest of what they call social justice. With respect to foreign affairs, it emphasizes solidarity with and fraternal support for governments and movements abroad that promote the same agenda. That much Glenn Beck gets right. What he misses is the fact that liberation theology is, in American terms, a doctrine of military interventionism as well. It contradicts the wisdom of the founding fathers, who were not perfect. They were not an assembly of demigods, as John Adams once said about the Constitutional Convention. These were people who did not excrete marble, to sanitize a famous line from the movie Amadeus. These were people, however, who did have a certain wisdom about how to avoid some of the worst outcomes in politics, and one very prominent tenet of that wisdom was the compelling imperative necessity to stay out of other people's affairs rather than barging around the world trying to promote goodness and righteousness at the point of a bayonet, at the point of a musket, point of a rifle. Now, of course, at the point of a Tomahawk cruise missile. The Founding Fathers did not support an interventionist foreign policy. That was something that came about in large measure because of Lincoln, unfortunately, and because the people who surrounded him, who were very much of an opinion that government had a very high and holy purpose in compelling people to be righteous. John Brown was one of the most prominent exponents of that point of view. He was one of the first religious terrorists to afflict the United States. But if you fast forward a few more decades, you can take a look at the social gospel movement that metastasized into progressive politics. Mr. Beck spends probably 5 or 6 hours a week or more execrating the progressive movement. And you know what? He's exactly right to do so. The progressive movement is one of the most deleterious political developments in human history. They were the ones who created prohibition. Prohibition mutated into the war on drugs. The war on drugs is destroying what remains of our liberty. It's utterly unconstitutional. It is completely vicious. If you want to know why Mexico is convulsed with violence right now, take a look at the war on drugs. We basically externalized to Mexico the violence that occurs anytime you have government intervention in a marketplace of this sort, where you've got people who are consuming a product that is not notably different from alcohol, which had been banned by the government in this country in a perfectly disastrous experiment that was inflicted on us by the progressivist movement, which was something that was cultivated in the churches in the late 19th century. Most importantly, however, the progressivist movement, the social gospel, America's liberation theology, was responsible for America's entry into World War I. And World War I, in my opinion, is the most disastrous event in human history in terms of its long-term consequences. Since the fall of Adam, there has not been a more consequential self-inflicted misfortune in human history than World War I. And there was a possibility, mind you, that if the United States had stayed out of World War I, rather than intervening and breaking the stalemate along the front in Belgium and France, that the antagonists would eventually have yielded to the earnest and repeated pleas of the first Pope Benedict. It's interesting how Mr. Beck doesn't mention him, and why it is that the current Pope Benedict took that name as his papal name. He had been pleading with the antagonists, the European nominally Christian kingdoms and polities, to accept his offer to mediate a negotiated resolution to that conflict that would have restored the status quo ante August 1914. Interesting. August is a rather crowded calendar in historical terms. Same thing is true of April. Not many of the things that happened in either April or August was worthwhile and uplifting and ennobling in the long term. World War I ruptured Christendom and created in its place a gaping hellmouth from which escaped every variety of totalitarianism to afflict the modern world. Totalitarian nationalisms began to pullulate across the Balkans and throughout the periphery of the mortally wounded Ottoman Empire. You had the emergence of radical Islam in large measure because of World War I. And, of course, Zionism, which was a movement that before World War I had not yet acquired the militaristic and bellicose features that are now characteristic of one strain of that philosophy. But that, of course, achieved a certain geographical prominence and permanence as a result of World War I, thereby setting up the conflict that still leaves the world palsied with terror to this very day. In places like Romania, Hungary, and of course in Germany, you saw nationalism and socialism create a hybrid that eventually became a bane to the world's existence. And in Russia, which started the war as a huge Christian empire, you had an affliction, an infection that had been propagated by Churchill when he sent Lenin into Russia in a sealed train from Zurich, like a typhoid bacillus. That was his expression for the purpose of creating trouble in Russia. What a favor that proved to be. All this happened in World War I. And if the United States had butted out of World War I and let Europe tend to its own affairs, there's a possibility. I'm not going to try to quantify that possibility in terms of size or weight, but there was a possibility that Europe could have stepped back from the brink and healed itself. But no. The liberation theology-influenced insufferable prig in the White House, Woodrow Wilson, working in concert with people who were similarly inured to the tenets of America's liberation theology in Congress, insisted on getting the United States involved in that war. And the world was changed irrevocably for the worse, including the United States. And that is why it is so important to recognize that the contemporary version of militarized collectivism that Mr. Beck is promoting at events like this so-called Restoring Honor Rally, which was this Saturnalia in celebration of Mars. How's that for a mixed metaphor? An astronomically mixed metaphor. It was a Saturnalia celebrating Mars. That's an interesting conjunction. Perhaps I should refer to it as Aries. Well, if I refer to it as Aries, then I'd have to refer to Saturn as Kronos. Never mind. I've overworked that metaphor. The point I'm making is that it was a huge orgy of militarism. And we had an event like that here in Idaho on Independence Day or around Independence Day in 2009 that was so similar to what happened today in Washington, D.C. Of course, in Idaho, you're dealing with a smaller event. You didn't have hundreds of thousands of people flock to Caldwell, Idaho, to take part in this rally, but it was the same type of an exercise where people get together and talk about all the horrible, abominable things that government does. Not many of the speakers today overtly talked about the horrible things that government does, but that, of course, was part of the necessary prelude to the symphony that was performed today. But they talk about all the evil works and pomps of the government, and then they spend most of the time in lachrymose and heartfelt praise of that element of the government that makes all these horrible things possible. And that, of course, would be the military, whether you're talking about the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and whatever assassination squads have sort of a joint and several relationship with the rest of the military-industrial complex for the purposes of foreign aggression, or whether you're talking about our increasingly and ever more overtly militarized domestic army of regimentation that we call law enforcement. Conservatives are besotted with uniformed agents of state coercion. This is the Levitical priesthood of the great and abominable church of the devil that we're talking about. The people who were, I don't want to apply the word Levitical in that context, but they are the equivalent thereof. These are the people who attend to the carnal law. That is to say, turning living human beings into dead meat. That's what they do. Ad majorem gloria state. And that, of course, is that element of the government with which conservatives are hopelessly enamored. And that's what this event was all about today. Gather at the central node of the empire and praise that element of the empire's apparatus of coercion that does most of the damage in the world. It's not to say that everybody in uniform is depraved. It's not to say that most people in uniform are depraved, but that's true of just about every society. Most of the Roman legionaries, no doubt, were honorable men. But their honor was perverted, and you cannot restore honor if you are involved in dishonorable undertakings. There's no way you can confer honor on wars of aggression in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. It just cannot be done. And it's quite frankly a form of blasphemy to invoke the name of God as you're trying to confer honor on crimes against God and man. I'm sure I'm going to have more about this to say in the second hour of the program. The first hour is now, of course, a wistful memory, but it will be available soon on the archives at Radio Liberty. LibertyNewsRadio.com. I have to remember which network I'm on. LibertyNewsRadio.com. It'll be up very soon. We'll be back with the second hour of Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.